Today is Thursday. It's November 5th, 2020. It's the worst year ever. The current time is 1:40 in the afternoon. I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record via Zoom. I'm not at WGN Radio right now, though you can hear my show weekdays from 9 to noon. I'm at home on vacation, pumping in love for the Mincing Rascals.
I'm Darlene Glanton, a columnist with the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the jumpy columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
You guys, we have so much to talk about today. What with the election still in play, we don't know exactly what the results will be. Election night, it looked as though the president had won re-election, and now 2 days later, it seems almost certain that Vice President Joe Biden will be the winner. We're waiting on results from Nevada and Arizona and also Georgia and Michigan and Wisconsin and so forth. We'll get to all of that in a minute. By the time we get done with this podcast, things may have changed yet again. But let's start with something we are certain about. Eric and Austin, maybe you guys will be the first to comment on the graduated tax amendment in Illinois, which did not pass. Eric, what do you want to say?
Well, I want to congratulate Austin. I think it was his performance on the Mincing Rascals debate and then his op-ed in the Tribune against mine that turned the tide in the voters. And the I would not say they narrowly defeated the graduated income tax amendment, but I will congratulate Austin on his incredible victory, and I will pledge to work together going forward.
I'll join the pledge, and thank you. It's very gracious of you, Eric. I do think that the op-ed probably tipped about a half a million votes, which is what it lost by. You're totally right. It was not just beat, it was clobbered. And especially outside of Cook County, it was absolutely demolished. And I think, I said this on WVON today, but the Illinoisans got the Carfax about the fare tax, and they did not take the lemon off the lot. It was demolished.
That's good. That's good. I'm surprised that, Eric, you think Austin's op-ed in the Tribune was so instrumental, since the picture that accompanied his essay, I believe, was from seventh grade.
I got a lot of flack for that.
He got the youth vote for that. Now, I was actually, I as you remember last week on the show, I predicted that the fare tax would go down, as did Austin. It was a high hurdle for it to meet. I kind of thought that it might get more than 50%. And as you know, there was this complicated supermajority that it needed to reach because it required an amendment for the state constitution.
Yeah.
It didn't come close. It was beaten by a majority of voters. Was it 55, 45, something like that? Or
55, no, 45, yes. And the key point was it got 500,000 roughly more votes than Donald Trump. So it was a bipartisan rejection of this tax question. And that's why it was really insulting, I thought, for Governor Pritzker to come out the day after and blame, billionaires and Republicans for defeating the tax when he could not even get his own party aligned on it. And further, then tried to go back to the same Illinois playbook of, well, since you rejected my tax hike, I'm going to have to hike taxes and cut services for poor people, instead of addressing the pension crisis. And it's the same false choice that people just rejected in droves a day ago.
But what's inevitable too, right, Austin? We knew that if this thing didn't pass, taxes would probably go up on everybody, or services would be cut for everybody, right?
Good luck passing it, because I don't know any Democratic lawmaker who just saw this get crushed in their district who wants to put their name on a tax hike right now. And I think for the first time it makes pension reform not only, politically possible, but, politically, I don't want to say probable. It's become very politically possible because the alternatives are finally being forced. They're being forced to make a tough decision.
And also, you have to keep in mind that whatever tax hike is enacted, that is going to go into place during a state budget year, which begins July 1 of 2021 July 1 of 2022, an election year. A gubernatorial election year that state lawmakers who are up for office, Pritzker who's up for office, they're not going to be willing to sort of, I don't think that they're going to put their names behind something like a tax increase and then walk into an election season with that. So I think it's going to be very complicated.
There will be a lame duck session coming up, I believe, which is traditionally when a lot of the General Assembly tough votes get cast. I don't know what they're going to do. I did a column a week or two ago where I basically argued that Illinois needs the money, and we're going to be in a world of hurt right now, partly because of the pandemic, partly because of four decades of fiscal irresponsibility. But it's not going to be quick and easy or painless to get ourselves out of this. And I don't know. I really don't know what they're going to do in terms of meeting their budgetary needs. But if they're going to make a tough vote, it's going to be very soon. And they're going to hope that in 2 years, people will have forgotten it or some other crisis will have intervened. Just one other point. This is a little bit broader question about the overall results. The Democrats lost, I believe, roughly two seats. Mm-hmm. I think we're not sure exactly. They lost two seats. Mike Madigan has a narrow supermajority now, right? Is that right, you guys? So he's got slightly fewer chips to play with. And so it really is an open question to me what they're going to do and how they're going to attack this. But I don't think they're going to want to raise general income taxes like they threatened to do. And I don't know that they can. I don't know that the votes will be there for that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how there's been sniping already on Speaker Madigan from Dick Durbin and from, I think, Rahm Emanuel this morning, or if I'm not mistaken, or yesterday, saying how him at in charge of the Democratic Party of Illinois was really hurting candidates. And believe me, plenty of blame to go around for Madigan. And I think he's helping Democratic candidates. But again, the fair tax that was on the ballot got crushed in these districts where Democrats were losing.
Why?
I think it got crushed because, number one, people do not trust Springfield with this power because they've done nothing to deserve it. And then they deserve that trust and have broken it at every turn. And also, I think the retirement tax message did penetrate with people. We did a little exit survey of folks who voted in October. Most common reason for voting no was, and this was among kind of swing voters, the most common reason for voting no is distrust in Springfield. Second most common was retirement tax. Then number three, some other reason. Number four, small businesses.
Austin, I think you're right. I think it is a distrust in government, state government. And when I think Madigan and Springfield and state government are inextricably linked. And so you can't underestimate the power of that. And Madigan has been linked to this ComEd scandal. And I think people are wary. I do think, I heard from a lot of people, I think the message too about sort of like, okay, they're reaching into our pockets again. They can't figure it out. They've reached into our pockets again and again and again. And I think sort of saying this is the cusp of them then reaching into our retirement funds, taxing our retirement. I think that is another message that got through loud and clear, whether right or wrong, because they were not going to be touching retirement money, taxing retirement money. The people were still afraid that this was sort of this is the last stand before that happened.
Politically,
you know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, Darlene, please.
No, I was just going to say, I would love to see an analysis of where the votes were cast and how people voted depending on where they live, particularly in Cook County and the Chicago area, because I really feel that I don't know that people paid as much attention to this in some areas as they probably should have. And I think when it comes around and we know we're going to have a property tax increase, probably a gas tax hike and other things, and there are going to be layoffs, and people are not thinking about maybe thinking outside the box about how we can stop, you know, this kind of bleeding of taxes that we're going to have to be paying. And I would love to see an analysis of where these votes came in, because I don't think people were educated enough about it. And I don't think they paid attention enough regarding, you know, what this would mean for them.
Well, so Darlene, I saw some of the numbers, I think late last night. And what I saw was that 71% in Chicago voted for the amendment. Then that yes vote fell to 53% in suburban Cook County, 42% in the collar counties voted for it, and then 33% downstate.
And that makes sense. That makes mm-hmm. sense to me. Because, you know, I think Chicago voters in particular, you know, are going to get hit really hard with some taxes. And, you know, we need to think of some alternatives. So, I don't know.
Well, the Chicago point was interesting because it was 70-30 yes in Chicago, but Biden was 80-20. So it underperformed Biden by 10 points. Oh. And if you couldn't have like 42% yes in the collars, you can't win any statewide election with that kind of number. I mean, that is really, really poor. And I think the rule of thumb for a lot of Republicans in Illinois is if you get 20% in Chicago, you're in good shape. The no votes got 30% in Chicago. So it really underperformed across the state.
Yeah, I think people weren't paying attention the way they should have to that amendment, really.
I'm not sure if it was the editorial by the Tribune, Eric and Lisa, or was it just a piece by Kristen McQuarrie? But I saw our former rascal, Kristen McQuarrie, who's on your editorial board, post a thing that said, okay, if you're going to, you know, change the Constitution and you really want buy-in, then how about we have a constitutional amendment for term limits or changing the maps? And we sure aren't going to get a chance to vote on those things. So it was just another reason to say, if something's really imperative, those issues are too. And I thought that was an interesting point. I don't know what your reaction to that is.
It would help their chances. I mean, if it's a referendum on trust, it would help if you took any actions whatsoever to engender trust in government and limiting your own power and addressing corruption and passing things like a balanced budget constitutional amendment that many states have. Or pension reform would show real shared sacrifice, a real change in culture in Springfield. Mm-hmm. And instead, we were only given the option to vote on the tax hike. Not everyone said no. A vast majority of people said no. Give them a chance to vote on pension reform. That's, I think, the logical next step.
Or at least sort of campaign, I guess, sort of campaign. We have this agreement in some shape or form that we are going to do pension reform. This is, you know, this amendment on the ballot is part one of part, you know, of a five part effort to really change how we fund government. And I personally I was a little bit shaken up by the whole, we're going to cut education, we're going to cut, you know, public safety, all these things that, you know, scare the daylights out of people. And then it makes me say, okay, well, I want to see what, it automatically makes my brain turn to, okay, Governor, let's see what what your office staffing looks like. You know, if you're going to come at it that way, I want to see, you know, first what your staffing looks like, for years now. And I know that he's paying some salaries out of his own pocket. So it's not like I'm not going to give him grief, I guess, that way. But whenever you hear that, I've heard that when I've covered the county, I've heard that when I've covered the city, you know, we're these doomsday scenarios. Okay. What does that staffing look like? At one point, Rahm Emanuel had a $1 million public relations team in City Hall paid for by you and me, the same people who would block us and not give us information. I'm paying them to say no comment. So, I mean, I think that there's probably some cuts that can be made in government without sort of sacrificing education funding.
That's a key point. Well, the social services have been cut continuously in Illinois for 20 years. They've been cut 30%. Pension and debt spending is up 500%. There's an elephant in the room here, and J.B. Pritzker's going out. It's like in a house, if you're going to compare it to a household, it's like, hey, I'm in really bad shape. My credit's really bad right now. Should I stop paying for this flashy car and the second house I don't need, or stop paying for food and clothing for my kids?
I've said from the very beginning that the reason we need the fair tax is so we can avoid these other solutions.
Either give me tax hikes or I will screw the poor and disadvantaged in Illinois. And it's so unfair because pension reform does not come out of his mouth. And I don't get it. He has to say it at some point.
He has talked about it. He talked about it in his state, I think his most recent State of the State or his budget address. And basically he said that he called it a pipe dream and said that we would be tangled up in litigation for years. There's no quick savings for changing pension formulas or distributions and so on. This is a long-term problem. It doesn't mean that you can't address it, but it means that it's not the answer to, it's not a quick answer to the budget problems that we have. He has mentioned it.
Let's move on to a couple of other items that were on the ballot before we get to the current state of the presidential vote count. What is the group's thought about the state's attorney's office?
I'll start. I was surprised that Kim Fox won so handily in that race. It never pays to vote against or predict against a Democrat in Cook County. But I just picked up a great deal of dissatisfaction from people, just in conversation, email with people who I consider to be moderate, middle of the road, even left-leaning people who were very frustrated and disgusted with her over the Smollett case and not sure that she had been all that swift in her handling of the looters and rioters after the George Floyd murder in Minnesota. So I thought that O'Brien's message of sort of going back to old school prosecution was going to do better than it did. I mean, he didn't even come close. That wasn't a nail biter by any means.
And I think, Eric, the question is, I mean, going with what you're saying, what is the alternative? And so, you know, the reason we tend to forget that the reason Kim Fox was elected the first time was because we wanted reforms, right? Mm-hmm. And so to a large extent, she has done that. And so the question on the ballot, as many people saw it, was, do we really want to go back to, a time when, reform was not even on a front burner? And we know what that meant for a whole lot of people in Chicago, a lot of people who don't have voices for themselves. And so I really think when it came down to it, you know, people kind of like, you know, what's going on with reform, especially in this era of George Floyd and, you know, everything else that's going on. You know, you can't say one thing and then turn around and vote on something that does the opposite. So maybe people are genuine.
I thought what was interesting, too, she won by a landslide. It was 54% of the vote. And you had this libertarian candidate who actually got 7% of the vote. So that splits it a little bit. But I don't think 54% is this huge mandate. And also what was interesting, Eric, to your point, you were talking, too, about how, there were concerns about everything from the Jussie Smollett case to handling of people who were looting downtown. And her big support base was in Chicago. It was suburban Cook County where her totals were, or her support was down. It was even closer there between her and O'Brien. So it makes you wonder what's going on. Are these white suburbanites sort of looking in from afar and saying, oh no, you know, look what's happening to the city. What is that?
I admit I was totally fooled. There was a tranche of votes came in from the suburbs kind of early in the night, and it put O'Brien out in front. Mm-hmm. I was watching the results updating, and I didn't say where they were from. And I sent a note around to some colleagues saying, oh, this is an earthquake here. You know, O'Brien is clobbering her. And then, of course, it didn't take too long for a bunch of votes to come in from Chicago, and it turned it all around. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. That was a very noticeable split.
But we also knew, I mean, if anybody were actually paying attention, African-American for support for Kim Fox never fail at all. Right. I mean, I think a lot of people saw this Jussie Smollett case as a victimless crime. Mm. And it was not enough to, it did not outweigh the reform that Kim had promised.
Because you, Darlene, you're right. That's always, even people who are critical, there's a two-step involved, especially if you're talking to progressives. It's sort of like, well, I didn't really like what happened with the Smollett case, but you know what, her view aligns with mine in terms of her plan for criminal justice reform, some of the things she's already enacted. And so I think that's probably where it falls. I also think you can't underestimate sort of the power of Tony Preckwinkle as the leader of the Cook County Democratic Party.
Kim Fox was my chief of staff for 2 years, a little more than 2 years. She ran for and was elected state's attorney. I'm very grateful for the good work that she's done there. And I think that she makes the decisions that she believes are in the best interest of the office.
In a rare sort of joint effort with Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who was out on the campaign trail election day, trying to help her and help the Judge Tooman, who is sort of a foe, I think, of the Democratic Party and viewed as a foe of Kim Fox, because he was the one that asked for the special prosecutor in the Jussie Smollett case. He said that a special prosecutor should be appointed and was appointed to investigate how Fox handled the case. But anyway, that 1-2 support, I think, of two powerful Democrats, Tony Preckwinkle and Mayor Lori Lightfoot, you can't underestimate that.
Of Lori Lightfoot. But Lightfoot, I mean, if we're going to segue into talking about Tooman, Preckwinkle was trying to get Tooman ousted, but Lightfoot came out pretty strongly saying she wanted Tooman kept on the bench, and Tooman did get what is, I think right now is about 62.5% of the vote. He narrowly was reappointed or retained, I'm sorry. and to me, an interesting element of that was just how close it came and how Preckwinkle and the opponents were talking all about Tooman's record as juvenile court judge. Suddenly this became up as an issue kind of late in the game. And I myself as a voter, I was thinking, well, I would have considered this if you'd made me aware of these concerns before this looked like just such a heavy-handed political move to punish Tooman over the Smollett case on Kim Fox's behalf. So I joined with my colleagues on the editorial board and the Sun-Times editorial board. Everyone got their backs up and said, hey, wait a minute. You know, we don't do this. We don't oust a judge because we don't agree with one of his decisions.
Yeah.
Well, is it also possible that he just wasn't a great candidate either? Back to the Kim Fox O'Brien case. I mean, did people really know him? Was there any energy for him, or was it all just a referendum on Kim Fox, yes or no? If we'd known him, if we'd liked him, if we'd seen him as some interesting alternative, that probably would have helped his case too, right?
I think having a known entity, I think the margin of her victory shows that it was possible to beat her this year. And I think that maybe the Democratic Party, I don't think her competition was too strong. And in the Republican Party, the competition wasn't really strong. It wasn't someone who had name ID already. I think you definitely could have gotten some, especially around potentially like someone known as an anti-corruption fighter, someone who has existing media relationships, who has been in the news about, you know, in regards to law enforcement or the law in the past in Cook County. That person would have had a real shot.
You know, I think the only shot they really had was probably during the primary. Because, you know, I mean, we're talking about a Republican versus a Democrat. You know, I just don't, as state's attorney, I don't know. That's a high bar, don't you think?
Yeah.
Agreed. Very hard for anyone to win with an R on their name at Cook County in any election cycle, not just this one.
Yeah. They should have had a better primary candidate, I suppose.
Right.
Well, Bill Conway was the candidate. He was a former assistant state's attorney, and he had tons of money. I mean, like more than $10 million he spent going after the small. He was a young, energetic guy, and he went hard after Fox for the Smollett case, and it just didn't register. I thought that was going to be closer as well. I think Kim Fox is she's a political force. I still think, though, that this Smollett case may block her aspirations. If she's got higher aspirations than state's attorney. That the Smollett case is not going away. And in fact, he's going to be tried, I believe, or maybe he'll just plead guilty. But that case is going to be in the news again. So if she ever wants to run, say, for county board president, or she wants to run for mayor or senator, then that's going to still be there for her, I think.
Well, I think the farther we get away from Smollett, I mean, I don't remember the last time I've even heard anybody. If there's a trial, you're right, Eric, I think it'll come up again. But I just don't think that case registered with the majority of people. I mean, because it was a nothing issue. It just didn't go anywhere.
I just judging from the email and response that I would get when I would write about it, it's very risky, I suppose, to try to gauge public opinion based on the response of Tribune readers necessarily, but people were quite animated by that case. They're very interested in it. I think one reason is because, unlike some of these kind of complicated questions, kind of like progressive income taxation, mm-hmm. which requires a lot, this is pretty high concept thing, faked hate crime, and Kim Fox and the mysterious decision to drop those charges. That was pretty easy to understand. So people did grab into it, but they didn't say, well, this is going to ruin Kim Fox's career, in my opinion. I'm going to give her another.
Let's stop talking about Kim Fox for and move on to a couple of other things. But I'll just say this, that I'm pretty amazed, because when we talk about the Kim Fox case on the radio, the Kim Fox case, the Jussie Smollett case, people just kind of roll their eyes like, is this really that important? I would judge much more important, how does she handle the looters and rioters and protesters, and how does she distinguish them, and who gets prosecuted and who doesn't? To me, that's the real guts of that office. And this, bizarre case of Jussie Smollett, to me, doesn't tell you that much. I don't think she was transparent. Maybe she was even dishonest. But does everybody really think that the Smollett case should have been as important as it seems to have been?
I don't.
Thank you.
It was important. I honestly don't think it was important.
Yeah.
I think the election returns show that it wasn't that important. I thought it reflected poorly on her judgment and her transparency and her honesty. The case itself was minor. And in fact, if she had just taken a plea bargain from him, no one would even remember. His name would be the answer to an extremely difficult trivia quiz.
Let's just talk about any other things on the ballot that jumped out at you guys before we move on to the presidential vote totals. Jeannie Ives lost, or at least last I checked it, there was 0.2 points between her and her opponent. Well, Jeannie Ives lost, but also Jim Oberweis won, and that one was extraordinarily close.
Well, we don't know that Oberweis won yet.
That still being counted? Still, hey, he was up 0.2 points.
Yeah.
I feel bad.
He declared it, but I think it's too early to call.
Her campaign people say there's still enough late votes, mail-in votes, absentee votes, and so on that could turn. It's about 1,000 votes, isn't that about, Lisa?
Yeah, it's 856, and he just launched a a recount fund, asking people to donate to that. So in case the Dems try to undermine the election, sounds very Trumpian almost.
Well, what mistake did Lauren Underwood make? Why does she struggle to win her seat back?
I don't know if she made any mistakes. I think that there was a question both in that district, which is a west, northwest, suburban, and exurban area, about that was a close race when she beat was it Roskam? I'm blanking. It was
a close race. Roskam was Kasten.
Those were both close races. There was a question about whether this was some kind of proof that the demographics are changing in the suburbs, and I think they are, but they were a very close race. And so when you're talking about turnout, things can, that can quickly shift, especially when it's a narrow win like that. So I don't know that she did anything wrong. I just don't know that that maybe that district is as solidly blue or becoming as blue as maybe we think.
Well, you know, yes. I mean, it certainly was a Republican seat. It was Randy Holtgren's seat.
Holtgren, yeah, that's right.
And she made a statement. It was in the Sun-Times editorial board meeting, and she said something about was referring to beautiful protests.
Oh, it was taken out of context.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was taken out of context. She said, with respect to rioting and looting, I think we have seen many instances of beautiful protests. And so what she was saying was that, yeah, there have been some rioting, looting, but much of the protesting is something that she found very inspiring and beautiful and so on, which I, as someone who believes in peaceful protest, I would agree with that. But again, when you're saying that, and then that remark was amplified over and over again in Oberweis's campaign commercials, I'll be sad to see her go. I thought she was a promising young congresswoman, and I thought that she was someone who had a pretty bright future ahead of her. Maybe she'll come back if she in fact loses this. But it was always going to be tough for her out there in that district. She's from Naperville, and it's never going to be easy out there for a Democrat. So,
especially during a presidential year as well, when many more people turn out than they do during the midterms.
Holtgren, I think, it was widely seen that he kind of didn't see this coming, and that campaign didn't really work hard enough to keep that seat Republican. So I think she got in kind of under the wire. It was very surprising, impressive that she took it in the first place. I thought it was interesting. One, if we're talking about mistakes, I thought purely politically, I was just looking this up, but Oberweis's 2006 ad where he's in the helicopter over Soldier Field talking about illegal immigration. I mean, that if I was Underwood, I would have been blasting that pretty much the entire campaign and really trying to cast him as very far right. But that can be tough in that area because you'll remember, I mean, people there are getting ice cream and milk from this guy's family business. Like, that is a really built-in name recognition advantage, mm-hmm. and not negative name recognition. The most positive recognition you can have is ice cream. So I think it was going to be really tough for her to win that.
If he wins, is it going to be an inspiration to Willie Wilson? Because, you know, Oberweis is sort of famous for running for office and losing. He ran for governor and Senate. I mean, and he got the nickname the milk dud because he kept running and losing for things. And so he, you know, he did get some purchase in the General Assembly, but if he makes it to the U.S. Congress, maybe the milk dud label falls off of him. And Willie Wilson, who's run for president and mayor, and has he run for senator also, or did he just talk about maybe doing that?
He just ran for senator. Yeah.
And Willie Wilson will say that, he did run for senator. Right, he just did. I forgot already.
Willie Wilson will say that regardless.
Yeah.
He will be running until he's broke.
That's Dr. Wilson to you, by the way.
Dr. Wilson. That's true.
I was a little surprised he didn't. He got about, 4% of the vote?
He didn't do that well. I was surprised.
I thought he was going to be more between 5 and 10. I thought he was going to hold Durbin under 50, which he did not quite do. Durbin was around in that same Fox area of about 53, 54, I think, right? I don't have those tables in front.
Yeah. Durbin, of course, won, which gets us closer to the top of the ticket now.
Oh, well, before we get all the way to the top, can we just touch briefly on the Supreme Court seat? Thomas Kilbride, the Democratic Illinois Supreme Court justice who was running for retention in a downstate district, in a Republican-leaning downstate district. He needed 60% of the vote approval to be retained, and he only got anyone 56, something like that. He didn't quite make it.
Yeah, he didn't make it to 60.
Which is, I think, it could be one of the most interesting results, one of the most consequential results of this entire election, which is this was a candidate who was tarred by Michael Madigan. His association with Michael Madigan was used by opponents urging a no vote. So the Madigan factor seemed to play into that. It's going to throw the Illinois Supreme Court is 4-3 Democrats over Republicans. Now it's 3-3, and they're going to have an election in 2 years. A replacement could easily be a Republican, depending on the districts, how they're drawn and redrawn, and everything. But you could see a realignment of power in the Illinois Supreme Court, which could change a lot of things, like questions that can get on the state ballot. Austin, do you agree with me on this?
Yeah, 100%. That is a race. I was talking about how kind of I think the fair tax brought down House Democrats as much as Madigan, if not more, in a lot of these races. But in his race, that was the one issue. There was a lot of late money there on television ads connecting him to Madigan. And it's not like those were trumped up either. I mean, he's taken enormous amounts of money from Madigan to get into that seat. And he has made decisions on things like term limits and on remap to take the voice away from voters on issues when Madigan and his associates challenged those rules. So I think it's for the Illinois GOP, I think that combined with the progressive tax win, combined with Madigan really underperforming, is just a trifecta. It was really remarkable. It's also the only time an Illinois Supreme Court justice has never been retained. It's the first time that's happened in state history.
And not only that, I think that we're sort of underestimating somebody who wasn't on the ballot but won, and that is Ken Griffin. And I am really wondering, he is the billionaire hedge fund manager, Citadel. He is the one that put up the big money for the tax amendment that failed. He put up the money to do that, the bulk of the money to kill that. And he put up a lot of money to derail Kilbride. And I'm just sort of wondering, I reached out to his people. I want to know what his next political moves are, because it feels like he's getting back in the game. He kind of pulled back. He had donated and helped bankroll Rauner and really supported him. And he seemed to sort of kind of move out of sight. He donated some money to redo the lakefront path. He donated a big bunch of money to have the Museum of Science and Industry. It was renamed for him. And so I thought, oh, well, he's going to go that route. But no, he's back in the politics game again. So no comment on that, by the way. I asked his people. He will not comment on whether he's going to run against Pritzker.
Lisa, don't be silly. A rich person with no political experience could never become governor of Illinois.
I feel so naive when I talk to you, Eric. Sorry.
I've wondered that, too. I wonder what Griffin's long game is. You think, if he didn't want to pay a graduated income tax rates, you could just moved himself and his business to Florida instead of spending $50 million or whatever it was he spent on killing that tax hike. I want to return real quickly to make sure we're not talking in code about the why Kilbride is so important. And that is that Illinois, it's very difficult to get ballot questions in front of voters in Illinois, referenda, to amend the Constitution. It's very, very, very narrow requirements. It has to deal with the structure of a legislature or something like that. So that when citizens pass petitions to get things on the ballot, this Illinois Supreme Court has routinely in the past just said, no, this is beyond the scope of what the Constitution has allowed. The Republican judges tend to be more have more latitude in what they think should be put in front of the voters. So that when Austin talks about term limits and pension reform, we're talking about the possibility that those kinds of referenda could be put in front of voters with a Republican Supreme Court.
Is that a good thing, Eric?
Independent of how I feel about either of those issues, I think those are the kinds of issues that voters should be allowed to weigh in on. Yes.
Yeah, I do too. In fact, I kind of, although you hate to have to see a Supreme Court justice be the victim, if you will, of the political whims of the day, I probably like that better than like the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, guys and gals appointed for life and maybe having trouble mentally or physically keeping up with the times. Maybe there should be some turnover in those offices, in those seats.
Yeah.
On to the top of the ballot now. So, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, although it seems like news stations and websites have been the constant thing in front of my eyeballs for the last 48 hours. Did everybody go on the roller coaster ride that we did at our house? It was very difficult to watch the results on election night. I went to bed thinking I would wake up the next morning to a Trump presidency. And I had that feeling for a couple of hours, and then the tide started to turn, and betting lines across the globe changed up and down through the night and into the next day. And today it's a 5-1 advantage for Joe Biden that he'll be able to clear the hurdles in Nevada and Arizona, and who knows, maybe Georgia, maybe Pennsylvania. It's, I think, right now a matter of the final votes coming in, and then whatever those results are, them surviving court challenges, right?
Who's on the top of the ticket again?
I'm sorry, Austin. Everybody's laughing, and I don't know why. So what do you suggest the result of that will be? I mean, sure, Donald Trump will hire a lawyer and fight anything he thinks is not to his advantage or is unfair. Do you think he has a case?
Not from what I've seen so far. I think it's pretty clear at this point that Joe Biden is the president-elect. But of course, this is someone who's coming at, I mean, Chris Wallace said this on Fox News right after he gave that speech at 2 a.m. I'm not sure if any of you guys watched that. Or was that like 1 or 2 in the morning?
I was, oh my God.
Yeah, it was really pretty frightening. And just kind of the rhetoric that was used. And it was what we expected, right? If it was close, he was going to be very bombastic about that and really allege fraud. And of course, and Wallace described it as sort of just throwing a match on a bunch of Tinder to be so bombastic before we even had, a lot of states were even counting a lot of votes. So that, but now that counting has been done, it does seem like Joe, that Biden is on the path to the presidency. I think the Senate staying Republican is also very interesting, which is what, unless somebody else has recent information, it seems to me that the Senate will not flip. But I could be wrong.
Yeah. There are a couple of things going on in Georgia regarding the Senate race that might be interesting to watch. As the numbers come in, they're mostly from Democratic areas with these mail-in ballots. The Democrat who is opposing Perdue is awesome. Rising. Yeah. And so now it looks like there's a real possibility there could be a runoff. And so that means you will have two Senate races in Georgia, of all places, that won't be decided immediately. So, you know, that still leaves some hope for Democrats who are hoping to at least get 50-50, right?
Well, I'm looking at, I am right now looking at WSB-TV in Atlanta, and they say that Perdue has fallen, he's at 49.98% of the vote, the Republican Perdue over John Ossoff. And if that holds, if he stays under 50%, there'll be a runoff there. And then there's already another run. So there could be two runoffs in Georgia.
Right.
And those two, it could well be that those two seats, if they both were to go Democratic, you would have at least a 50-50 split. If Joe Biden is president, 50-50 split means that Vice President Kamala Harris would have the deciding vote. That would be enormous, because if Biden is elected, as Austin Berg has predicted, he's got a Republican Senate against him. He's not going to get anything done. Nothing at all. Mitch McConnell is not going to let him get anything. He's going to have to appoint moderates and Republicans to his cabinet if he wants them approved. If any judges he wants, he's going to have to go through. It's going to be pretty much bad news all the way around for a President Joe Biden. And it's going to be hard for him to run his party to run in 2022. The midterm elections are probably going to be brutal for Democrats, because they'll have been exposed as not being able to do anything, which is the logical thing that's going to happen. And it probably makes a Republican president in 2024 more likely, which is why it's my guess that there are a number of Republicans who are quietly hoping that Trump does lose, that they would much rather have an ineffectual President Joe Biden for the next couple of years than to have this bombastic, rage-filled narcissist Donald Trump ruining their midterm and 2024 chances.
Well, he could still do that. I mean, what he's looking at starting a media company that would compete with Fox. And he's already dribbled out there that he might run again in 2024 if he loses time. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure we can predict anything. You know, it could go that way, Eric. It could also go the way that sort of Mitch McConnell and some of these other folks who have aligned with Trump may sort of decide, okay, I've got to sort of rehab here because people are falling away, or, you know, take that hard line and don't let Biden, if he wins, get anything done. I think it'll be interesting to see just how that all falls together.
I mean, remember,
I agree with, go ahead.
No, please go ahead, darling.
I was just going to say, I think you make an interesting point, Lisa, because, you know, maybe this is just a dream on my part, but, you know, Joe Biden has been around for a long time. He's one of the guys, right?
Yeah.
He knows how to work both sides of the aisle. And Mitch McConnell, you're right. He has more to gain, I think, by trying to, this is definitely going to be his last hurrah, to try to make some amends for some of the things he's done, especially what he did with Obama. Now, I don't know if he's a good enough person to even want to do that, but here's his opportunity, you know, if he did indeed. And Biden's a good guy. You know, people like Joe Biden.
Yeah, that's true.
So we'll see.
Well,
think about it that way. That's a very that's a better point. So,
Darlene, how much confidence do you have in the process and the count itself? If the purpose of an election is to discern the will of the people, and suppose it is that, in fact, more people, more electors want Biden to be president, how much confidence do you have that the process will reveal that truth?
I mean, are you asking if I think what they're doing now is, I'm not sure what the question is. I'm sorry. I don't, what are you asking?
No, it was really flowery the way I put it too. I'm really sorry. I'm trying to figure out if between the court cases and the counting of the votes and the moving of the ballots from one place to another, where they're going to be reviewed again, you've got all of these gears trying to discern what the will of the people is. How much confidence do you have that this thing will reveal that truth?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that, and I was just thinking about this morning. One of the things that I think is being revealed are some things I'd never thought about before. Like, I never really thought about what happens to those provisional ballots. You know, you just always thought that they just didn't get counted because nobody needed them at the end. But now they're actually, you know, talking about how they're going to count those provisional ballots and what has to be done. And I think that the process right now is very open. I mean, there are some places where they're counting ballots, even that they have a video going and people can see, you can tune into the, you know, Secretary of State's website and look at the counting process. Now, I also have to take this from the perspective of someone who was in Florida during the 2020 recount, which was a circus and the most ridiculous thing I had ever seen. We're not at that point. So this is very different, very go by the rules, very open for anybody who wants to really pay attention to what's going on. So I am confident that they are counting the ballots the way they should be. Now, let me just say one other thing. Two of those lawsuits have already been dismissed. So I think the one in Michigan, I think, and the one in Georgia have been tossed out. Because, you know, they just didn't have any merit. So I really kind of think that what's going on with Trump is that he's like going crazy, like, you know, saying you got to do something, you got to do something. And the lawyers are just trying to come up with something to do.
He's a bad loser. No question. Uh-huh. He's a bad loser. Trump is a bad loser.
Oh, absolutely.
He's a bad sport. These lawsuits, I think none of them have any merit. And I've also got to say that I've been impressed by just about every state election official I've seen interviewed on television.
Yeah.
Like they are really determined to do this, as you said, Darlene, openly and thoroughly, and they're going to count the votes, and they're not going to be intimidated into stopping or starting the count by people who are gathered outside their offices. They've given me a lot of confidence. I wish that our system were standardized and faster so that we weren't sitting here all these days after the fact, wondering, you know, how many votes there are in certain counties. But I feel confident in the results. And in 2016, it was a very narrow victory for Trump. I never doubted that he won the Electoral College, you know, fair and square. I never thought that the vote count was corrupted in any way. And
you think that they got Florida right? Oh, I'm thinking of, pardon me, finish that thought, Eric. I was thinking
I'm talking 2016.
I'm thinking about
2000. 2000, that's all a blur to me now, but I remember thinking that the Supreme Court stopped that process way too quickly. And that was a mistake. I don't know what, I think there's been a great deal of research done about those ballots and what would have happened. And my recollection is that Bush still would have won, but again,
you're correct. I mean, they did. They found that they kept counting, and that's what they concluded.
Okay.
Well, one of the reasons I think I asked that question, though, is I'll be very sad if Donald Trump wins re-election, because I don't think he's a good president. I think he's a bad person. But I think I'll feel even worse if the election itself is corrupted, either because of courts or somebody manipulating something along the way here right now, right? I mean, I don't know what would make me feel worse, Donald Trump getting elected or Joe Biden get elected, because the election process is flawed. And, you know, you're just watching all of these things happening in all of these states and all of these ballots and all of this law. And you wonder, I hope we get it right. More people voted for Donald Trump in this election than anybody in history, except Joe Biden, who's going to beat him by 3-4 million votes. So, you know, kind of as a purist, you do hope that the election will reveal what the people want, right?
I think one of the things that I'm trying to read sort of every sort of constitutional law professor and attorney who's kind of weighing in on what challenges might be ahead, and almost to a person, no matter what side of the aisle they seem to be on or leaning toward, they all seem to say that this stuff is fairly cut and dry, and then they extrapolate on that the fact that Donald Trump knows how to use the legal system to his advantage. He's done that. I'm not weighing in or having an opinion. This is true. He's done that. But taking somebody to court civilly for something like that versus challenging an election, those are two very different things. And one of the things we learned overnight is that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was calling around to try to find an attorney who had sort of this James Baker type of approach, sort of low key but powerful. James Baker, who handled the Bush Gore challenge of 2000, and helped Bush prevail in Florida. That's not what's happening here. And so it's sort of like they seem to be sort of grasping at straws, some of the people around him. I don't know what he's doing, because we haven't heard from him for a couple of days. The president, he's tweeted and so forth, but we haven't really heard anything from him. But I don't think you get the sense that, you know, that this is the legal challenges are just sort of grasping at straws, that there's no there. And even some of these county level, I think it was in Nevada and Las Vegas today, the county clerk there was saying, you know, we know about the legal challenges. nothing's going to happen here. We're more concerned about people's safety because we have other people reacting to these legal challenges without thought to the safety of our staff. And so he was really ticked off.
Yeah.
So it just feels like this, it's really going down this road that, I don't know, that has a big dead end sign down it.
Well, you know, the thing that we have to remember too, is that 2000 was about ordering a recount, right?
Right.
And what Trump is trying to do is stop the count. So they're opposites.
Right.
So there's really nothing. This has nothing in common with what happened in 2000.
Right.
And the other thing is, I mean, the allegations that Trump is making, or the charges he's making for stopping the recount, isn't based on any reality. So, you know, why stop the recount, other than the fact that if you keep the recount going, I'm going to lose? I mean, there's no reason there.
Are you saying that our president is detached?
He is saying you have to stop the count at midnight, that midnight on November 3rd. That is his base.
Absolutely.
There is nothing in law. As long as those ballots are filled out by then, for these various laws that allow sort of the mail-in ballots to come in a few days later, there is nothing that prevents those ballots from being counted even next week, because that would be part of the recount. Then you could recount them. If you're going by that logic and that argument, then you could not even do a recount.
And that's, and what's so funny is to hear Trump supporters in places like Arizona and Nevada saying, count the votes. And then they're in, like, you know, Pennsylvania saying, stop the count. It's the weirdest thing. It's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. So I don't know how anybody
it was a plot in an episode of Veep, actually.
Yes, it was. Really? Yes, it was.
Maybe that's where he got it.
Hey, John, I want to correct something you said earlier. You said that Trump has the second most votes in the history of the presidency. Right now, he is about 800,000 total votes behind what Barack Obama got in 2008.
Ah, pardon me.
Is that Trump or is that Biden? Who are you? You said Trump.
Trump has got the third most votes in a presidential election ever. He's at 68. Right now, he's like 68,700,000. Obama was at 69,500,000 or so. In
69, yeah.
So it's not yet past that, but he might, by the time we're all done counting, he might be in second place, but Biden's got the most votes in history.
Well, then I say stop the count.
Stop the count! Stop the count! Stop the count!
Stop the count. That's a hell of a chance.
My understanding, if you stop it now, Biden would be president, right? Because right now he has Nevada and Arizona.
Depends on what
start
state.
Start the count. Start the count. I got to switch.
Well, but you know, the president is acting like someone who knows he's going to lose, right? Like whatever internal polling or people on the ground they have that might be feeding them information about, hey, don't worry, the ballots will come in or they won't come in, right? I mean, I'm sure they've got some sort of internal mechanisms. And he sure is acting like someone who's getting really bad information from his team. Otherwise, why would you be fulminating or why would your fans be chanting stop the count or stop the count? We're about to get kicked out of this Zoom meeting, guys, so we'll leave it here now. But any last thoughts from you all as we wrap up this Mincing Rascals podcast? Eric, what's foremost on your mind?
Well, this isn't foremost on my mind, but we passed 10,000 deaths from coronavirus in Illinois today, and it's a very sad milestone. And anybody who thought that this was all going to go away after the election, it was all a hoax, the numbers keep coming in, and it's pretty grim. But
here's my last thought, Eric. I think that's been a false equivalence all along. I mean, maybe the COVID count is what doomed President Trump's candidacy, his reelection. But I think CNN and a lot of the world spent way too much time saying, well, if the COVID count goes up, then the president won't win. His supporters didn't care. Maybe it didn't pick him up any, you know, people who were on the cusp, but the idea that a high COVID count means a low turnout for the president was not borne out. And I thought that as a metric that was, you know, people were putting way too much emphasis on that.
I agree. And I actually kind of poo-pooed that. I just figured that was sort of one 16th of a pizza slice of the view. I think people would turn out en masse on election day. I think that is what happened. My final thought is that this race is so close though, nationally. I'm concerned that this is going to be four more years of just sort of, I don't know, just this general feeling of meanness in the country. And I wish that no matter who wins, you know, there was a question about this morning, I think on MSNBC, I got part of it and I liked it. Sort of like, we're just all going to have to figure out a way to live with each other. You know, it doesn't mean we have to accept these views and challenge, doesn't mean we don't challenge each other on these views. But I wish that sort of we could sort of get together and say, we're going to just get through these next 4 years, no matter who it is, and figure out a way to live with each other. I don't know. Maybe that's being the youngest of eight kids and wanting to be a peacemaker. We just got to figure out a way.
Well put.
My final thought is that I am so glad that we will never go back to the way we were, because the things that have come up in this country under 4 years of Trump have always been there. Yeah. And we just kind of kept them hidden under the rug. They're out in the open now. We're either going to have to deal with them or we're going to have to live like this for the rest of our lives. So it's going to be our choice what we want to do. But I'm glad it's out in the open.
Austin?
I have a similar thought about the state of Illinois. And there's a Warren Buffett quote where he says, when the tide goes out, that's when you know who's been swimming naked. And the tide went out for Illinois and for Illinois finances. And they're going to finally, for the first time, have to reckon with why the state budget is the way it is, why, and by extension, how terrible the state's economy has been for the last decade or so, as we've continued to drive businesses into the ground, continue to drive people out of the state. And there is going to have to be some honesty for the first time in budgeting in Illinois, some honesty around the House Speaker and potentially a transformational vote there in January. So I think Illinoisans should have a lot of hope for the future of the state after rejecting this at the ballot box, the tax specifically.
I got dibs on that line. I'm going to use that next week. That's pretty good. The Warren Buffett line. Okay. We'll end it there. Thank you, Austin. Darlene, we always appreciate it when you join us. Lisa and Eric, well done, everybody. Thanks for being part of the Rascals. We are produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams, and we will drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.